Graceful Atheist Podcast. Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Graceful Atheist Podcast. My name is David, and I am trying to be the Graceful Atheist. If you are in the middle of doubt, deconstruction, and the dark night of the soul, you do not have to do it alone. Join our private Facebook group, Deconversion Anonymous, and become a part of the community. You can find us at facebook.com/groups/deconversion. Thank you to all the supporters of the podcast. If you too would like an ad-free experience of the podcast, you can become a supporter at patreon.com/gracefulatheist. Please consider rating and reviewing the podcast on the Apple Podcast Store and on Spotify, and subscribe to the podcast wherever you are listening. Quick shout out here to everyone on Spotify. It used to be back in the day that the metric showed almost exclusively Apple Podcast listeners. These days, Spotify is making a run. This is not an ad for Spotify, by the way. Just wanted to say to the people listening on Spotify, there are all kinds of ways to comment, to interact with each other, to interact with me. I'm trying to keep tabs on that. So reach out, tell me what you think of the episodes, what else you'd like to hear on the podcast. Please do. I'm trying to respond to comments as they come in. This episode is a Deconversion Anonymous episode. If you would like to tell your story, anonymously or otherwise, please reach out to me at gracefulatheist@gmail.com. This week's guest is Julia. Julia was torn between two grandmothers, an evangelical and a Jehovah's Witness grandmother. She became a Jehovah's Witness and was all in. She got married, had kids, and that's when the boredom set in. Her story is amazing. She is now experiencing freedom from the high control religious aspects of Jehovah's Witness, as well as the typical suburban life. She says she's in a wonderful state of indifference, and you'll have to listen in to hear what that means. Here is Julia to tell her story. Julia, welcome to the Graceful Atheist Podcast.
Thanks, David. It's great to be here.
You had reached out to me, had some really nice things to say, and also a nudge in the direction of remembering my roots and focusing on deconstruction stories. And I said, hey, well, why don't we tell your story? And you have given me a bit of a written version of that, and I am just blown away. So I'm excited for listeners to be able to hear this. So we're just going to start where we often start. What was your religious life growing up?
Well, my parents weren't religious at all, but both of my grandmothers were very religious. One was Baptist and the other was one of Jehovah's Witnesses. And as a child, I didn't realize that they were both trying hard to influence me to be their religion.
Yeah.
My parents had a lot of issues, so my childhood was unstable and chaotic. My grandmother's homes were my safe havens, and they both had a really positive impact on me and cultivated in me an interest in spiritual things. Mm-hmm. When I was with my Baptist grandma, I went to her church. She paid for me to go to Bible camp out of state every summer. And I also went with her to the North American Baptist Triennial Conferences throughout the 1980s. And then when I would stay with my Jehovah's Witness grandma, I went to the Kingdom Hall, which is what they call their place of worship. Mm-hmm. And I attended Bible assemblies and conventions if I was with her when they were going on. So I was always curious about God, the Bible, and religion. I'd go to any church I was invited to. And at the library, I read books on world religions.
Okay.
As a teenager, I ended up in foster care. I lived with a family who required me to attend church. They didn't care what church I went to. I just had to go. So I was, you know, at this point 15, I didn't drive. So I just started going to their Catholic church with them. And when my Jehovah's Witness aunt found out, she offered to bring me to the Kingdom Hall instead. After a little while, her husband offered to study the Bible with me. I brought a notebook full of questions to the first study.
Yeah.
My uncle told me they'd all be answered eventually in their study book at that time. It was called you can live forever in paradise on earth.
Okay.
Through that Bible study, I was shocked to learn that Christmas wasn't in the Bible. God had a name, and many holidays had pagan roots. So I'd felt like I'd found the truth. I took to heart everything I learned and started to conform, including not celebrating holidays and birthdays. So the summer before 11th grade, I moved 200 miles away. A sister, which is the term for a female member in Jehovah's Witnesses, She contacted me and offered rides to the meetings at the Kingdom Hall. She picked up where I'd left off studying in the Live Forever book. I started going out in field service, which is the door-to-door preaching work. And it was really nerve-wracking knocking on doors.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people felt like I did, hoping no one would be home or answer, so we could just tuck a tract or watch Tower Awake magazine in the door and move on so we could get our time in. And that is because back then we had to log our monthly hours and placements.
Wow.
But in November of 2023, they stopped requiring detailed reports.
So back then you were obligated, not only obligated, but you had to log it in some way.
Yeah. At the end of every month, we had to hand in our report, and it detailed, you know, if we conducted a Bible study, how many tracks, how many magazines, how many hours down to the 15-minute increments.
Wow.
And if you did not hand in a report for 6 consecutive months, you were no longer counted as one of Jehovah's Witnesses.
Wow, that's very serious. So I know we're going to probably introduce a term at some point, but high control religion. I mean, that's what it sounds like you're describing here.
Yeah. And I feel like that report was used to gauge your spirituality, You know, your level of spirituality. If you had low hours, you were going to get talked to about it and encouraged, you know, to put more time in, and how could you increase your hours, placements.
Right.
So at my high school, I met a boy from another congregation. We started talking a lot, and we even arranged to be in some of the same classes. This caused panic in his family because I wasn't raised in the religion. I was worldly.
Yeah.
Worldly is the term witnesses use for anybody that's not a Jehovah's Witness.
Right.
So witnesses only date other baptized witnesses, and only with the intention of getting married. There's no recreational dating. So by the summer after 11th grade, I had progressed to the point of getting baptized. My Baptist grandma was so upset about it that she told me I was being removed from her will.
Mm.
Looking back, I think I gravitated toward the religion because I didn't want to end up like my parents. As a welfare kid overseen by the state, I wanted to know how to have a better life. And the witnesses guaranteed a better life now and forever in the future.
You can say no to this. What led to you being in foster care? What happened with your family that put you in foster care?
Both of my parents had a lot of mental health and not just mental health. They were both alcoholics. They were, you know, Previously drug users. They kind of lessened on that as they got older. But none of them ever wanted to have a child.
Mm.
I would have been my mother's third abortion, and she had me when she was 19. She actually got caught. She did not want to have me. She had gone up to her mother's, my Jehovah's Witness grandmother.
Mm-hmm.
She had gone up to visit. Unbeknownst to her, she was 3 months pregnant with me.
Oh, wow.
And she was sick at her mother's house. She was sick. And my grandma was like, I think you're pregnant. I'm going to take you to the doctor and we're going to see if, you know, do the test. And I can only imagine what she was thinking, like, oh my gosh, like now I can't get out of this.
Oh, man.
You know, the other two she was able to do in secret. But so I basically was born to people who didn't want me. And that was the general feeling I had all growing up. I did stay with my grandmother's a lot growing up and ultimately ended up in the foster care system.
Thank you for sharing that. I appreciate that. And I'm sorry that you had to go through that.
Yeah, thank you. So a year after graduating, when I was 18, we got married. It's pretty common for Jehovah's Witnesses to marry young because you can't have sex before marriage. Mm-hmm. And then we had two children. My husband eventually became a ministerial servant, which is like an assistant to an elder. They don't have a pastor or a priest. They have a body of elders.
Okay.
So then later he became an elder himself. And we became like a model family. Mm-hmm. We were interviewed and even acted out demonstrations on stage in front of thousands of people at Bible assemblies and conventions. So as a witness, I lived in a bubble associating only with other witnesses. I tried hard to be a good, submissive wife. And thankfully, my husband gave me a lot of freedom.
Okay.
He owned a business, so I worked for him in our home office while homeschooling our kids. As a mother, I was strict. I didn't want my kids contaminated by the world. So we rarely watched TV or movies. And our life revolved completely around the congregation. At that time, we met a minimum of 4 times a week. And with preparing, attending, and preaching, there was little time for much else. So around 10 years in, boredom really set in during the meetings.
Okay.
There wasn't much intellectual stimulation. To stay focused, I started taking incredibly detailed notes and turned it into a game, trying to predict the scriptures the speaker would use next. I actually got quite good at it.
I bet, yeah.
Because same information was constantly recycled.
Yeah, interesting.
And in their literature and talks, we were often told we are the happiest people on earth. But the truth was, I wasn't happy. I would wake up every single day thinking, I hate this world and I hate this life. But I had to shrug that thought off and just power through the day. I didn't know the term for it then, but I later learned that it was cognitive dissonance. I wanted a different life. I dreamed about selling everything we owned and moving to a foreign country. I felt inspired by stories of need graders, which is what the organization calls people who move to countries where there's a greater need for preachers.
Okay.
So we applied to go to an international Bible convention in Ecuador, and I was thrilled when we got accepted. I was trying to convince my husband to make it a month-long trip. But shortly after, he was diagnosed with terminal cancer.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So instead of Ecuador, he was in the hospital recovering from surgery. He spent a total of months in the hospital, and I stayed with him in the room. Because my husband refused blood transfusions, the surgeon questioned his sanity and ordered a psychiatric evaluation just to prove my husband was competent to refuse blood.
Wow.
The surgeon was totally baffled by the logic, asking, if you'll take blood fractions, why won't you take the donated whole blood they come from? Hearing him try to reason with my husband, I began to think, this doesn't make sense. But accepting a blood transfusion is considered a serious sin, and you would be disfellowshipped for it. So multiple surgeries proceeded without it, adding greatly to my husband's suffering.
Wow. I don't actually know the history of where that dogma comes from. Is there a reason why blood transfusions are not allowed?
There is a scripture in Leviticus and there's prohibiting blood, but of course transfusions aren't mentioned in the Bible. It wasn't.
Sure, of course. Yeah.
But they apply a scripture in what you'd call the Old Testament and the New Testament about not using blood, and blood is sacred. They feel like blood is sacred, and when it comes out of the body, it needs to be poured out onto the ground. This is the reasoning they've always used.
Okay.
But in March 2026, very recently, the governing body, who is a group of men at the top, at the world headquarters in New York, they changed the rule on this. Members can now store their own blood for later use, but you still cannot accept another person's blood.
Interesting.
So medically speaking, this policy change is practically useless. Stored blood expires within a few weeks, so it won't help in an emergency. Plus, doctors can't draw blood from someone who is already weak or fighting cancer. So it's an extremely rare circumstance where pre-storing your own blood would even be an option. Now, while we were in the hospital, family came to visit. One of my in-laws said, "We just need the new system." And that's the term for a future paradise on earth after God slaughters everyone who isn't a witness.
Okay. Okay.
Right. And I had never focused on that teaching.
Uh-huh.
I was more interested in the Bible's practical advice for daily life. So an unexpected anger just blazed up inside of me. And I yelled that the new system didn't solve anything for us right now. My husband needed life-saving treatments today. And they left shocked and shaken up.
Wow.
My reaction.
Yeah. Although, what a perfectly normal reaction to have. Your loved one is suffering. And the pat answers are no good in that scenario.
Exactly. So long stays in the hospital actually brought relief from our obligations, like attending meetings. When a couple of elders came to visit us in the hospital, they opened their Bibles and read a scripture about the God of all comfort. Something in me just snapped.
Okay.
I held up the Bible and yelled, "There isn't anything in this book that is going to help my husband." And then I threw it across the room, almost hitting one of the elders.
I love it.
I was losing it, you know, under stress.
I can only imagine, but yes, that makes sense.
The look on the elders' faces was complete shock.
Yes,
I don't
I bet.
Think I'd ever had a Bible thrown at them before.
Yes, it's a completely new experience, yeah.
So after my husband passed away,
I'm sorry,
I took my kids on a biblical tour through Turkey, Greece, and finally Bulgaria, where we attended a international Bible convention. When we got home, I decided to finally chase my dream of being a need writer.
Mm-hmm.
I packed up the kids and we spent 2 months traveling through Colombia and Ecuador preaching.
Okay.
I remember crossing this raging river in Colombia on a wooden board wedged between boulders, thinking, my ministry dreams have finally come true. It was a dream for me. I loved it. I loved everything about it.
Yeah, you wanted to be out there adventuring and preaching, and you got that opportunity. Yeah.
Yeah. So back home, something started to really bother me. I was giving rides to a couple of single moms who didn't have cars, and even delivering food shelf items to one of the women whose abusive husband had just left her. But I was criticized by people in the congregation for doing that because they weren't making progress in their Bible studies.
Oh, wow.
So it forced me to cut them off. And it was really awkward and painful. And they had no idea why.
So, like, just so I understand and the audience understands, so because they weren't checking the right boxes of what progression that the Jehovah's Witnesses believed needed to happen, they didn't want you to have contact with them anymore?
Correct.
Wow.
Yeah, if they, because they stopped progressing, you know, and there's always a book, you know, back when I was coming in, when I was learning about the religion, it was, you can live forever on paradise on earth. I'm not exactly sure of the title of the most current book because they update it because they make some changes to prophecies and, you know, rules. So
yeah, okay.
They have to provide updated versions, and then they do change the titles too slightly.
Okay.
So it's expected that your student will accept the information and make changes and then keep going towards baptism.
Got it. Okay.
Because you can't just show up at a Kingdom Hall and say, I want to get baptized. No, there's a long process. You have to go through study material. You actually have to sit with elders and answer. It's like over 200 questions you have to answer from the Bible. So you have to qualify.
Yeah, there's a barrier, not a barrier to entry, but like there's an expectation of what a person understands before they're baptized.
Exactly. But having to cut those moms off, when they were in crisis, just because they stopped progressing, it felt completely wrong.
Makes sense to me.
About a year after my husband died, I started feeling unstable. I was also having distressing physical symptoms that I couldn't control. I confided in the elders and I went to doctors, but nothing helped. Then I started hanging out and drinking with witnesses who were judged spiritually weak.
Okay.
Prior to this, I had only drank alcohol a few times in my whole life. My kids were suspicious of my unusual behavior, so they went on my phone, read incriminating text messages.
Oh, no.
Yeah. And told the elders.
Wow.
In witness culture, we are taught to narc on each other. So my own kids were trained to be informants.
I'm sure that was very painful to have your kids do that.
It was, at the time, I think I just felt like they were doing what I taught them to do. Really.
Interesting. Okay. I see.
Yeah. So I wasn't mad at them. It's hard to explain how I felt, but I trained them to be this way. So
the whole system trained them to be that way. But yes, agreed.
Exactly. Yeah. So after that, the elders asked to meet with us as a family. When they questioned me alone, I didn't hesitate to tell them the truth. That's when they told me they would form a judicial committee, which is three elders who would decide whether or not I would be removed from the congregation. So I felt very guilty and I was extremely sorry for what I did. But during my judicial meeting, the elders pointed to their private book of procedures called Shepherd the Flock of God. It's a book that's not available to the average member. It's only for elders.
Okay.
And they told me I was not repentant.
Okay.
I was stunned. It was at this moment that I began to question if the elders were led by God's Spirit, because if they were, surely he would have revealed to them how I was truly sorry. Sitting there, I told them I felt like I was a wounded lamb being thrown to the wolves. they just looked at me with blank faces. Mm. They wouldn't even conclude with a prayer. The public announcement was made at the next midweek meeting. So after 27 years of being a faithful Jehovah's Witness, I was expelled.
Wow.
I've always felt like the elders were basically spiritual police officers.
Okay.
Yeah. So when I committed a crime, they sentenced me to a minimum of 1 year of solitary confinement. Disfellowshipping is it's a shunning. Nobody could say hi to me. Nobody could send me a text, an email, check up on me, call me.
Oh, man.
Everybody cut me off completely, except for my children, and my children only because they lived in my home.
Wow.
If my daughter, who was of the age where she could have lived on her own, if she didn't live with me, she would have had to cut me off completely.
So it really was solitary confinement. Like you lost all of the relationships in your life.
Exactly. So at a time when I most needed support, I was cut off from everyone I knew since I was 16 years old. It was actually harder for me to deal with than the death of my husband, because I was alive, but everyone treated me like I was dead.
Mm. Wow.
So then I dove headfirst into a dumpster fire.
Okay. As one does.
Yes. Yeah. I became what one relative described as a hot mess.
Okay.
And it was a messy, chaotic, but also transformative couple of years.
Okay.
Being thrown into the world against my will was a very disorienting experience. It was a massive learning curve for me because I was naive and culturally clueless. My religion was my whole identity. I didn't even know how to talk to people in the world.
Okay.
There were a handful of witnesses who secretly kept in contact with me, but I quickly learned some were living double lives. One sister helped me by introducing me to people at bars, which was a pretty wild place to start for someone as sheltered as I was.
Yeah.
It was really weird to me that some witnesses started confiding in me about the naughty things they were doing.
Yeah.
It's like I became a human confessional for the underground witnesses.
Wow. So there's like a whole, like, underground's the right word, underground group of people who are kind of holding each other's secrets, but still know each other. That's fascinating.
Yeah. I don't want to say it's a minority of people, unless I'm still naive about this, because when I was in the congregation, my friends were good people. They weren't doing anything they weren't supposed to do. Sure, they weren't perfect. None of us are, but none of them were flagrantly disregarding any rules or prohibitions.
Well, because the consequences are so high.
Exactly. So during these years, I made many trips to Central and South America, bringing large suitcases full of things for poor communities. I created people projects that I didn't consciously realize at the time were fulfilling my need to feel needed.
Mm. You were doing your own mission trip, as it were.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. That's amazing.
Without the dogma.
Right.
Without any conditions. So it felt wonderful to help people without an underlying agenda. So after 1 year of being disfellowshipped, I wanted to get accepted back. So I resumed attending every meeting. And while being shunned, no one there could even crack a smile at me. To get reinstated as a member, I had to meet with the same elders that disfellowshipped me. I was super nervous about meeting with them because I was still struggling with some things. But to my relief, they decided I would be reinstated.
Okay.
I was also in disbelief. It struck me again that the elders could not be divinely guided because I didn't feel like I should be reinstated.
Interesting. Yeah. So they got it wrong twice on the way out and on the way back in. Yeah.
Yep. So when the announcement was made at the midweek meeting, I felt completely flat. The second the meeting ended, all these people who treated me like I was dead for 2 years suddenly rushed up to me.
Wow.
I just wanted to bolt. I ended up leaving the state to spend time with a terminally ill relative, which was a perfect excuse to get away. Now, I was still having conversations with people about the Bible. And because of me, a couple people started going to the Kingdom Hall.
Wow.
Yeah. One even started studying with an elder.
Okay. Okay.
But after a couple of months, he shocked me by saying that the best thing that could happen to me was getting kicked out again because the religion was toxic.
Okay.
My knee-jerk response was, no way. I do not want that to happen. I didn't want to be cut off from my adult children. They were really what I cared about the most.
Yeah.
After this, the elders wanted to meet up with me. Because I was traveling frequently, it was put off. Eventually, I ended up in a group text with three elders who were trying to pin me down on a day that would work. I was checking my calendar, and one elder accidentally replied to the entire group instead of texting the others privately. The message said, don't tell her what we want to talk to her about.
Wow.
I was shocked. It felt like I was trying to be trapped. I immediately blocked all their numbers.
Good for you.
It was right after this that a painful dismantling began. I had suffocated doubts for so long. All the little things I had filed away for years began to surface. Comments householders made to me. Things acquaintances said. Statements made in a memoir I read a decade prior about a girl escaping an extreme Mormon cult. How I'd always felt about shunning and the procedure for handling child sexual abuse. The rule about not going to university, the intolerance for questioning policies, interpretations, or rules, learning the parallels between Christianity, ancient Egyptian beliefs, and Greek mythology, ironically, on a tour of the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York, given by a Jehovah's Witness.
Nice. The truth has a way of seeping in.
Yeah. I admitted to myself that I didn't like the cruel, jealous, violent God of the Bible. Mm. The scales fell off about Jesus, Mary, and Paul. And I thought about the witnesses who were quietly breaking the rules in private because they were afraid of losing all their friends and family.
Yeah.
So other things came to mind too. I wondered if my Jehovah's Witness grandma even really loved having me around, or was she just logging field service hours?
Wow.
Was that my aunt's motivation and the others who studied the Bible with me? I began to wonder if all the love and friendship I was ever shown were merely out of duty. So deconstructing felt like trying to get out of a straitjacket. I was wrestling with many upsetting thoughts and conclusions, but I was also trying to figure out and rebuild who I wanted to be. A moment of self-realization happened when I was playing a question card game, the kind you use for icebreakers.
Okay, yeah.
I pulled a card that read, "When you look in the mirror, what kind of person do you see?" I just stared at that card and felt a longing to get back to the person I was at heart. From that moment on, I started living authentically, but without the dogma. So then my kids started pulling away. I kept reaching out, staring at unanswered texts and emails. The thing is I actually taught them to be motivated by religious rules, not love. One time I stopped by my daughter's place and she told me not to show up unannounced again. I thought it was really ironic for a Jehovah's Witness to say that.
Yeah, exactly. Yes.
So what helped me the most to deal with that painful rejection was a book by Dr. Joshua Coleman, The Rules of Estrangement. To sort things out, I journaled a lot, went to therapy, and had some sessions with someone familiar with Jehovah's Witnesses. I learned phrases like love bombing, religious trauma, complex PTSD, and high control religion. I read books and listened to podcasts about people going through faith crises. Mm-hmm. And I actually came to realize the unhappiness I felt as a witness had layers. It wasn't just about a heavy religion. I didn't like living the typical suburban life script.
Okay.
Solo life is where I thrive.
As you start to deconstruct one thing, other things deconstruct as well. And so maybe just the expectations of suburban life was one of those things for you.
Exactly. So being shunned helped me learn so many things about myself, Christianity as a whole, and the world. And after years, I finally arrived at this wonderful state of being indifferent.
Interesting.
So I lost a lot of labels that identified me, but I don't care to acquire new ones. If you ask me what I believe life is amazing. I don't need to accept any of the current answers to questions man has been trying to figure out since the beginning of recorded history. I don't need a blueprint to appreciate a house. Yeah. I'm fascinated by science and nature, and I'm deeply grateful to be alive.
That's amazing. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Obviously, all of that was incredibly eloquent. Do you want to expand a little bit on indifference in that you don't need to conform to anything? But what does that mean to you?
Well, it's indifferent in regard to I don't feel bothered by what people, well, in general, if they explain their beliefs, even if they're trying to convince me to think or feel a different way, it just doesn't really bother me.
Okay.
And I feel indifferent toward people in the religion. I don't have a desire to like go on social media and look them up and see what they're doing with their lives.
Right.
You know, I don't feel like I'm missing out on whatever they're doing.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I remember someone that had gone through a divorce telling me that it took them 10 years to get to this place of indifference, which they felt like was the ultimate healing place. You know, they didn't feel hate. They didn't feel love. They just felt indifferent.
Okay. Well said. Yeah, I like that. Another phrase that you use, you know, and you really should be a writer, is smothering doubts. I thought that was really an interesting way to describe that. On this side of things, what are some of the things that you are interested in these days? You mentioned science and various other things, but what are the things that give you passion and meaning today?
Well, I still travel internationally. I still have my people projects.
Okay.
So I'm still continuing doing that, but I read a lot. I write a lot. I spend a ton of time in nature. I restored a historic cabin that was originally built in 1865.
Oh, wow. So okay.
I feel like I have kind of like three lives. I have a cabin in the North Woods that I restored, and it's, you know, in a beautiful location on a river, and I kayak on my river. And I kayak all over the USA actually too.
Oh, wow. Very cool.
Yeah. And then I started converting cargo vans into campers back in 2020. And so I have a camper van that I travel in all over the USA.
Oh, fun. Yeah.
Yep. And I just, you know, when I'm at the cabin observing wildlife, studying plants, I pick a lot of plants and make custom blends for tea. And
excellent. As we wrap up here, I think people who are listening to this podcast have already made a change of mind of some kind or another, but let's imagine that there's a young Jehovah's Witness person who's listening to this, who's just at the beginning of those doubts. What are some of the things that you would have wanted to have been told when you were at that stage?
It's kind of hard because as a witness, you're prohibited from looking at information outside the religion.
Yeah.
So, and in fact, it's something I never, during my deconstruction, I did not go on YouTube and look at, you know, apostate videos. I didn't read apostate literature. But that is strictly prohibited. So I don't feel like everybody in the religion is completely miserable. I feel like, you know, I don't need to convince anybody to leave it. I wouldn't do that towards a Baptist or a Catholic or a Mormon.
Right.
I think there are plenty of people who are satisfied, content. They're just fine. They're just fine in it. And even if they're not just fine, the options might not really be that much better. I had asked someone after I was disfellowshipped, someone else that had been disfellowshipped like maybe two or three times when they were a witness. I said, "What keeps you going back?" And he said, "I just haven't found anything better out there in the world." I mean, that's how he felt. You know, his whole family, his whole community was there. It's a lot to lose. It's extremely painful. And that's why it took me years. I don't understand these witnesses who were raised in the religion and then just one day, bam, they're out. Just like,
yeah. Interesting. Like,
I wasn't even raised in it, but I couldn't let it go like that.
Right.
Even now, you know, I live like a Christian, but without the branding.
Yes. You know? Yeah.
And exactly. I still find value in the Bible too. So, but I can find value in other belief sets also.
Right. Yeah. There are no limitations on what you can explore, what philosophy or religious ideas you can explore, that kind of thing.
Exactly. One of the things that's really amazing to me now is that I have friends who love me for who I am and not out of obligation or for what I believe. And it's amazing to me that even though we think or feel differently on subjects that can divide a whole nation, they just acknowledge our differences and we remain friends. So I learned how to exchange ideas rather than try to convince someone to think or feel the same way I do.
Mm.
And I'm a lot less judgmental than I used to be. I feel like I have a lot more empathy, compassion, and understanding for people inside and outside the religion. So, you know, personal autonomy is a foreign concept to Jehovah's Witnesses. The religion dictates how you dress, how you speak, who you can love, and what you are allowed to think. But now that I live completely autonomously, it feels so liberating. And I actually wake up every day thinking, I love this world and I love this life.
That is amazing. That is fantastic. Just one last question, Julia. You mentioned a book, The Rules of Estrangement. Any other books, media, podcasts, that kind of thing that you would recommend for people that are going through the process?
Well, of course, I recommend this podcast.
Yeah, I wasn't fishing for that, but yes.
No, it helped. It was like a soft way for me to, I don't know, absorb. Just listening to other people's stories and how everything they went through, it helped me so much, even though it wasn't the same belief set or faith.
Right.
There were always, you know, especially in fundamentalist religions, there was always elements. There was things that were similar. Like that memoir I read, you know, many, many years ago, when I was reading it, As a Jehovah's Witness, I was like, oh my goodness, like, ooh, that kind of sounds like, that's like us.
Yeah. Yeah.
But then I just put it on the shelf, you know?
Exactly. No, I hear you. I had very similar experience. It also was Mormonism that I was looking at, where I was like, oh, they see me the same way I see them. And it is interesting when you start to look outside of the prescribed information set. Julia, I want to just thank you so much for what an eloquent story. I think there's going to be many people who really relate to that. So thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Thank you.
Final thoughts on the episode. Julia's story is amazing, and she is incredibly eloquent. Although Julia's story was tragic, the time lost in the high control religion, losing her husband when it might have been possible to avoid his death. But also it is a triumph of taking her own autonomy and overcoming. Although the story of throwing the Bible at the elders is funny, it was also an act of independence. And I think that was a completely beautiful story. I just have a few quotes that really stuck out to me. She talked about a painful dismantling began, and that she had suffocated doubts for so long. That concept of suffocating doubts expresses so much of what it is like to be going through the cognitive dissonance, and I just loved that. She said, deconstructing felt like trying to get out of a straitjacket. I was wrestling with many upsetting thoughts and conclusions, but I was also trying to rebuild who I wanted to be. Again, what an apt description of the deconstruction process. And near the end, she says, I finally arrived at this wonderful state of being indifferent. And as she explained, she means indifferent or impervious, I would say impervious to the beliefs of others. So not being swayed by the beliefs of others or the persuasion of others. And I love this. I think that the deconstruction process inoculates us from the demagogues in the world. And I think that Julia expresses that beautifully. And now the freedom that she experiences, being able to kayak on her local river and rivers all over the United States, and not conforming to what is expected of her as a suburban woman, is absolutely amazing. Julia, thank you so much for being on the podcast. I appreciated your honesty and your story, and I think many, many people will benefit from hearing it. Thank you. The Secular Grace Thought of the Week is about autonomy, inspired by Julia, and the sanctity of your thoughts. I've heard many Jehovah's Witnesses, as well as evangelicals, use the phrase physically in and mentally out. And I think that Julia experienced that for some time. But here's what's important even within a high control religious environment where actions and behaviors are highly regulated, no one can regulate what you think inside your own mind. There is a purity, and I'm using this religious word, sanctity, a beauty of your own internal thoughts. No one can police those. There are no thought police. If you find yourself in a situation where you are being highly controlled, freedom is found within your own mind, your ability to think critically, to determine what is true and what are falsehoods. And you can make plans to get out, to be free, to be safe. If you find yourself in a high control scenario, safety is the number one concern. Finding a friend or a relative who you trust with your life that you can run to is probably the safest way to go about it. But having a plan in the sanctity of your own thoughts and executing that plan to be free, to regain your autonomy. Freedom on this side of deconstruction and deconversion is wondrous. There are no bounds on what you're allowed to think, what you're allowed to study, what you're allowed to explore. And you can determine on your own what you believe or don't believe. And no one else can tell you what you have to believe. Until next time, my name is David, and I am trying to be the graceful atheist. Join me and be graceful human beings. If you want to get in touch with me to be a guest on the show, email me at gracefulatheist@gmail.com. For blog posts, quotes, recommendations, and full episode transcripts, head over to gracefulatheist.com. This is the Graceful Atheist Podcast.